Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Would You Date a Scientist? I'm Wendy Gannon, your host, and I'm joined by Mike Holmes, Head of Data Science at Market Finance. Hi, Mike. How are you?
Hi, Wendy. Yes, no, I'm fantastic, thanks.
Good,
good. How are you doing?
Yeah, no, I am good. I was just saying that I was at a conference yesterday. I mean, that makes it sound posh, doesn't it? It was an expo yesterday, the day before, and it's struggled to get back into it. I've got so much to do. I need to write lengthy lists. But yes, I am good. I'm good. I do like to ask twice, like, actually, how are you?
No, I am. The biggest light in my life at the moment is I'm a new dad. And so that's kind of given me this new bright outlook on life. So it's really nice that even if you have like a bit of an off day, there's something for me to brighten up with at the end of the day. So yeah, genuinely doing fantastic at the moment.
Brilliant. It changes your whole brain, doesn't it? The way you look at things, everything changes like in a split second. So Mike, what's your favorite piece of tech?
Yeah, no, I thought about this. Probably the calculator.
No, oh.
This is about the fifth thing that I thought about, by the way. But I thought about the calculator because it's so like partly is because I'm a mathematician and everybody knows that mathematicians cannot do mental maths.
Does that mean I'm a mathematician?
go on if you want. It's so simple, but it's kind of like the basics for logic is maths, and that sort of tool is. I kind of think if you're ever learning a program language, the first thing after you type is hello world, and then the next thing you do is 2 + 2, and actually that's like the fundamental basis of maths and calculators help us to do this. And probably a calculator. I've been around for a long time, but it will always be here in one form or another.
The abacus, yes. Is that an actual thing? Hello world, and then 2 + 2.
It's the first two things that I've learned. I'm sure that that's still the way that people are taught in university or online courses, but it's been a while, so I'm ready to be corrected.
I love that. So you're head of data science at Market Finance. Can you talk me through your career firstly, and then we'll talk about how you got into data science? Or you can merge the two if it's easier.
Okay, so I think I'm quite unusual in the sense that I've had a pretty linear career, and not many people I speak to have linear careers. I always wanted to go and do maths at uni, and I'd always been interested in finance. I did a placement year at my university that worked in financial services and credit risk, and then that led on to a job after university, and then I've kind of always worked in financial services. I guess in financial service, particularly in lending, data science, or what it used to be called more predictive analytics, has been around for sort of 30 or so years. And at that time, the industry was much more ahead of the curve to other industries. And so actually, like, I feel like I've been in data science longer than data science has been around. It was just under a completely different name. I spent 3 years at my first company, 8 years at my next company, who went through a couple of mergers and IPOs and the like. And then sort of 15 months ago, I joined Market Finance, which is a sort of late stage startup, and was a real beneficiary of the remote working revolution, because I live in Yorkshire and the company's based notionally in London. So that was like a bit of a silver lining of that, of some of the byproducts of the pandemic for me.
Brilliant. Head of the curve. So what's your favorite project that you've ever done? If you've been doing this for that long, I'm sure you've done many, many projects. So what kind of thing? And it's always been in finance, is it?
Yeah. So my favorite projects are probably more those that you'd maybe describe more as task level than project level. And that's because like data science doesn't always have to be like super sophisticated. And I've done some beautifully simple things that have delivered like huge impact for the business. I did one project sort of within the last 2 years, and it was on a technical level, I would describe it as a single feature regression model, which is just about as basic as you can get in the world of machine learning. But we did it fast. Everybody understood it. It turned out to be right, which is always yes. always good to see. And yeah, it delivered a huge impact to our customers. And like that, like what more can you want than that?
Absolutely brilliant. So when we had a chat previous to our recording, and I hope you're still all right to talk about this, we talked about imposter syndrome. Now, I have had imposter syndrome. You mentioned that you've had imposter syndrome. And I think it's really important if we have a conversation about this, because imposter syndrome in women is talked about a lot. Well, certainly I've seen it talked about a lot, but not so much in men. So I think it's going to be, you know, let's get rid of all this toxic masculinity and, you know, let's talk about it if you're okay to do so. Can you talk me through kind of your experience with it and talk through your experience with it first, and then we'll go into if it's stopped you from doing things, how we can help?
Yeah, I think the first thing that someone needs to do is kind of realize that they're suffering from this, because if they don't, you can never take action. And I have learned that there's a name for this phenomenon, which is the Dunning-Kruger effect. And it can happen both ways. You can have people who suffer imposter syndrome, that they actually know more than they think they know. But there's also the danger that you're on the other side of the line.
Right,
that,
okay.
That there's people who think they know more than they actually know. And how do you get back to making those two things equal? And it's that process of feedback and self-reflection. So over time, I do think I've got a natural tendency to feel imposter syndrome, but I've kind of think that there's that process of feedback really helps to validate someone's knowledge and sort of make you identify any gaps that you can correct on.
Yeah. So it can be quite debilitating, can't it? I've had it maybe a little bit now, to be honest with you, but I've had it in the past where, you know, I don't think I'm good enough to do something. My photography, I don't think it's good enough. Am I a good enough recruiter? Can I run my own business? You know, I've only been doing this for, like 8 years now. People have been doing it for longer. Comparing myself to other people, and I don't think I realized what imposter syndrome was until I spoke to somebody and I said, I don't think I can do this. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You literally doing it and doing it well. And I don't think it's until people actually reach out and start sharing what they're feeling that they can be told and then realize that they've got imposter syndrome, and that's when we can start working on it. So if anybody out there feels like they're not good enough, you are, you definitely are. Or if you feel like you're going through imposter syndrome, you can definitely reach out to me and I can talk you through that. But yeah, what kind of stuff has it stopped you from being able to do you think?
I think it just kind of makes me pause for hesitation a little bit more, or go into things a bit more hesitantly. Yeah, I guess it's best with real life examples, isn't it?
Yeah.
I was moving from a large corporate to my current job, and you know, I was really excited to be a head of data science. Like, yeah, cool job title. You know, I call the shots. That sort of initial kind of feeling. But then you think, well, actually, who do I look up to when things go wrong? You know, and I'm coming into it. I've just spent 8 years in an organization where I know everyone. I know my way around. I've got my networks. I've got my safety net, and now I've got no one. And it, you know, as much as that remote working revolution that's been so positive for me, you're actually going, well, how can I build up those relationships quickly when I'm sat in these four walls? So there can be an awful level of self-doubt that, yeah, that kind of creeps in. And I think it can be quite, you can kind of spiral a little bit, that initially what is a challenging situation, you can create as an impossible situation, mm-hmm, in your mind. And I mean, what I did there is I just tried to break it down into logical tasks. So, okay, well, what problems do I have? I've got a set of problems. Okay, let's tackle one at a time.
Yeah.
And so, okay, I'm going to make sure I go to the office. I'm going to make sure I just build up relationships with people. I'm not going to talk about work. I just want to meet them.
Yeah.
And things like that. And slowly as you kind of get through that, you get that validation, you get that feedback, which is so important. And I think that when you get one piece of feedback, that can boost your mood and your positive outlook and your energy towards fixing the other problems. And before you know it, like that big problem, you've broken down, and lots of little problems, it's so much more manageable to solve.
Definitely. And I think with myself, I have imposter syndrome about things that I can, that I've already done. So it's very bizarre. I've got a coach, Kathy, she's helped me with this. She's like, what have you done this month? Nothing. I don't think I've done anything. She's like, all right, have a look at your calendar. Let's talk through it. I'm like, oh my God, I've done so much stuff. And I think it's taking a step back and looking at everything that you can do. And also remembering that you're not going to progress in life if you don't do things that are a bit scary, that you're going to struggle with, you know. But it's bringing yourself back to now and stop worrying so much. I mean, anxiety is a horrible thing, but it's trying to live in the present and bring your brain back to that. It's a tricky subject, very tricky subject.
And putting yourself outside of your comfort zone is a positive thing.
Yeah.
But like there's probably like a safe area where you can just like gradually little and often put yourself outside of your comfort area. You know, after 10 years in your career, do you want to say I've got 10 years experience, or do you want to say I've got 10 lots of 1 year experience? And like the only way you get to the former is by trying new things and sort of putting yourself out there.
Yeah, great point. So have you got any tips for people who want to get into data science, either through academia or pivoting? Lots of people want to pivot into data science. Have you got, what tips or tricks have you got for those people?
Okay, I guess my tips will feed I follow on from that imposter syndrome theme, because I think the data science industry kind of generates more of an imposter syndrome feeling, and part of that is because so many job specs look like they're chasing unicorns and they want everybody to do. I don't know why people do it. I don't know why people do it, because they don't exist. And one of the things that was really powerful for me to learn is this concept of a T-shaped career, that there's, you find the one thing that you're really good at and like you focus on that, and that's part of your career identity.
Yeah.
But then you try and get a little bit of knowledge in every other area. And I think thinking about what your career identity is and where you want to go, rather than just trying to scattergun learn everything, is going to be a really good way to start thinking about how you build up that early stage skill set. And of course, it will evolve over time and you'll find different things that you're gravitated to, but not to like I said, too much scattergun approach it.
Yeah, I think with that as well, if you focus on one thing and then you become a master of it, then you know how to do the learning curve of the other things as well. Because so many slot together. I think that's a really, really good, really good tip. Thanks very much. What do you think data science is going to look like in the future?
I think I'm very much a one industry person. So I have a really deep view about that, about my industry, and a very kind of vague view about other industries. I think the different industries are on different maturity curves of that. And I think that like in my industry, explainable AI is so important because when we're lending money to people, sometimes it's very, very large sums of money. You want to be able to justify a decision, not only to your stakeholders, but also to regulators. So I know at the moment there's lots of really interesting developments around explainability. Last year I read a lot about like kind of auto ML as a movement that actually what is the role of a data science going to be? Are you going to have more kind of platforms that enable more people to get into data science, you know, no code solutions and so forth. I'm a purist myself. I think that code is logic and code will always exist. So I don't necessarily subscribe to that, but I do think that the industry will evolve in the way that it's going to evolve,
how would auto ML work then? Auto machine learning, how would that work if there's no code?
So I guess there's always going to be code at some end, but ultimately I guess it's shifting more onto that software engineering side, and you're going to have people trying to commoditize open source in like very pretty graphic interfaces, and then they're going to go and pitch it to the senior execs and say, look how shiny this tool is. And then you don't have to hire PhDs anymore. You can open up this is so much accessible to your existing workforce.
Yeah. Okay. Makes sense. Speaking of PhDs, one of the questions that I sometimes ask is, do you think it's important for somebody to don't have a master's or go into PhD?
No. In my team, I think it's important that some people have PhDs, and that is purely from a diversity perspective. I love the team that I built at Market Finance, and there's people with all sorts of different backgrounds, and that just brings a huge diversity of thinking. PhDs might be really, really powerful for some roles, but most of the time it's going to be like more of a research role. And those people with research mindsets, powerful in some instances, but equally it can hold people back in other ways of thinking. So at an individual level, I don't think it matters. As a manager, I just love to embrace diversity of skills and thought and background.
Oh, brilliant. So how's your team made up? How many are there to start with?
So we have three data scientists, and then we've got three BI analysts. But we think it's important to say that we have data engineering is a skill rather than a role. I sometimes think that job titles can be misleading, and we've got these people are much more than just their job titles, and actually that comes down to diversity again. I don't need a team of unicorns, but I want the squad to be the better than the sum of its parts, and like diversity of skills and looking at skill gaps in the team. Yep. When we grow the team, because the company's growing at quite a fast rate, the next person that I'd look for would be more, okay, well, what skills are we missing? How can we make the team stronger rather than just try and look for that individual like unicorn that's not out there.
So that's really nice to hear. I think that your team should be the unicorn, basically what you've just said.
Exactly
team should be the unicorn. I think, let's running back to the job spec piece, people who are looking for somebody to come into their team put down everything that they want. Okay. And then they don't necessarily want all the person who's going to come in. They don't necessarily want that person to have everything, but they put down, you can have this and this, or this and this, or this and this. But because everything's on there, it puts so many people off, especially people who identify as women. It puts so many people off. Statistics show that people who identify as men are more likely to apply for a position if they've got 5 of the 10 things needed, and if women have got 9 of the 10, they still won't apply. So if you're a hiring manager and you're doing this, please bear that in mind. You're going to be alienating a diverse mix of people from applying for your position. But yes, you're quite right. The team should be a unicorn. Job titles are a nightmare as well. I think both from the hiring side, because I mean, to me, they don't matter. When people start working with me, you can be called whatever you want. I really don't care. Just do your job. I think coming from actuarial headhunting, job titles are very, very important to actuaries. And I completely understand that. You know, they work through their actuarial exams, etc. But with data science, I don't know what I'm trying to say. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter to the company, and it shouldn't matter to the candidate. But if it does matter to one of them, then just go with it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, changing somebody's label is the easiest thing that a company can do. And I do think that, like, job titles are not important to some people, but they're very important to somebody else's self-identity and, like, their career identity. So, you know, if anyone came to me and said, like, I want to be called, like, chief acrobat or something like that, I'm like, you know, if it makes you happy, like, like, what's getting in the way? Like, bureaucracy, who creates the bureaucracy? I create the bureaucracy. I'll get rid of the bureaucracy.
Yeah, exactly. I can understand it if somebody's worked their way up through their career and on their CV it says senior and then they go back to junior. I understand that. Just let them have that senior. So diversity-wise then, brilliant that you said that diversity brings diverse thinking. It's not just about how people look, or it's about the different experiences people have had in their lives, right? And that makes a big difference to you.
Yes, and like I do believe that I want to maximize all axes of diversity apart from one, and that is just alignment to the company's vision. Because we need to find a common cultural ground and to be able to buy into, like, the North Star and the mission of the company. But beyond that, diversity of skills, background, thought, all of those sort of things. And, you know, you mentioned about job specs. I've been through that process as a more junior hiring manager, where I've changed my incredibly verbose list of essential requirements, really stripped them down. Some I deleted, some I put into a desirable kind of group, and saw what my flow of candidates changed overnight.
Yeah,
and brilliant. So, like, it I guess it's all very well, like, people hearing the theory, but to actually go and make that leap and that change and actually see the results, because when you're like me and you want to hire somebody, the biggest problem in hiring is you want the top of your hiring funnel to capture as many people as you can, because that's, you're having your net out as far in the ocean as you can get is the most chance that you'll catch the fish that you want to.
Definitely. How do you think having that diverse team is helping your, you know, diverse algorithms?
So you're kind of talking data ethics and that sort of thing. Yeah, it's so, like I said, there's a few axes to that we want to have a very holistic thinking. Whenever you approach any data science problem, you think about that problem first before the solution, and that helps you to think about, you know, how do I get that data? How do I process it fairly? What assumptions am I making? What limitations are there? And actually, assumptions and limitations are incredibly important to document down as you go along, I think you can make an assumption very early on in a project and think, okay, I'll come back to this later. Before you know it, it's baked in to your output. And then you can have a bias model, a bias algorithm, and models aren't biased. Models are sort of, they're true to the data and the assumptions that they're trained on. And who decides that? It's a human behind the algorithm.
So data, historically, I've asked this question over the last few podcasts, and I don't think there's ever going to be an answer, but maybe you can help. So historically, so when we started taking data, it was very general white cis het male data. Yeah. And then obviously it's broadened out to include ethnicity, gender, all diversities. So there's this bit of data, which is white cis het male. And obviously the white cis het males continue to go, but we're just getting more diverse data. But that data is still going to be majority white cis het male, because it's been going for longer. How are we going to stop that from happening?
Okay, I'll kind of give you an industry example here and then kind of maybe talk about how it might translate to other areas. So, like I say, I've worked in financial services a long time. They've had data, they've had algorithms for a long time. And some of these institutions have like 30 years of data, you know, fantastic. But how much has the world changed in regulation, economic downturns? You know, there's like Brexit and pandemic and stuff like that. And there's these constant points that are biasing what would be like a super clean, massive data series.
Yeah.
And so, I guess the simplest technique that we have or that I've used in the past is to say, okay, I've got this time period A and this time period of B with this change in the middle. Can I quantify the change? What's the change between that? And when you know what the difference is and when you understand the difference, that helps you to know how can I use and adjust the older data to be relevant in the modern day context?
Right.
Because without that process, like that time series of 30 years is just an utter mess, and you'll get like loads of bizarre signals out of it.
Yep.
But like, we're not like in the financial services, we're not trying to serve the past 30 years. We're trying to serve the next 30 years.
Yeah.
And maybe in your example here, I'd want to understand, what is the differences in these CVs of the skills and the backgrounds, and like, how are things evolving? Like, and actually some of that historic data might be relevant and can be reshaped or even reused in its current format, and some thrown away and discarded. So I do think there is a process where you can maximize the value of old data, but like, I'm a big advocate that 80% of data science is about understanding and cleaning your data.
Because
if you do that, the rest is easy.
Yeah. Okay, that makes perfect sense. Thank you. Do you think we're ever going to have clean data?
I think that everybody would be out of the job with this clean data. No, and I think there's this like illusion that one day there'll be a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow and like everything's going to be clean. But I just think the world moves too fast. I think things can get cleaner, but I think that we're going to hit a ceiling in terms of how clean things can be. And like, what is today's?
And then there won't be enough data.
Yeah, what is today's modern tech stack is going to be tomorrow's legacy tech stack as well. We're going to find new ways of, you know, new data sources that we do wrong first time and so forth. So yeah, no, we should chase that dream, but I don't think we'll ever get there.
Brilliant. So we were talking about explainability earlier. Who should set those requirements?
I guess ultimately it comes from the customer, but there's like definitely a role to play as a data scientist here. It's almost like the customer knows what they want and the data science knows how they want it. And sometimes as well, I guess the customer doesn't truly know what they want. What they know is their problem.
Yeah.
And so I think that in this case, if we want to understand what the requirements are for explainability or anything else, questions, listening, defining that problem statement, you know, why do we want this? You know, who do we have to answer to? Like, in what scenarios will we have to explain? You know, is it to a regulator, a customer, so forth? So, debt is always worth discovery conversations at the start to really know what the requirements are.
Brilliant. New question. It's just popped into my head. Don't know if it's going to work or not. We'll see. If you could work on any project ever, what would it be? Or it could be a project that's already been done. It could be a project that you've got in your head that you think might be fun to do, or something that you just want to fix. Is there anything that you can think of?
Oh, well, that is a very, I struggle with questions that are so kind of broad, to be honest. back to imposter syndrome.
Let me try
and answer it. I've mentioned I've been so engrossed in one industry, and yeah. I kind of feel like if new problems come across, my domain knowledge will help me to be like on the front foot for knowing how to approach it. But actually, I think there's going to be such a breadth of data science problems out there in other industries that it'd be really exciting just to try and solve those. And it's not necessarily to say I want to give a particular impact from that project, but it's more that kind of excitement of learning and trying something new.
Brilliant. Okay, so what punishment would there be if a billionaire made some evil villain, super villain, to take over the world? What punishment should they have? I mean, is it happening already? Can it happen? How are we going to stop it?
Okay. I have watched conspiracy videos before, which suggest it has already happened, even though I'm not a conspiracy theorist. What tools are already available? Economic sanctions, they're already available. But is that really going to be enough if somebody's gone that far? Economic sanctions, they can't use their money that they've amassed.
Yeah.
And then if they're just like money is worth nothing if people don't recognize its value.
So then that they'll be lovely.
Yeah, they'll be sat in their evil lair alone, like very, very lonely.
Oh dear.
But then, you know, always I think that, you know, if somebody's done something naughty and you've put that punishment on, you need to show your soft side as well to show that there is a path to retribution, to say like, look, like we can put this behind us, like there are going to be consequences, but we can at least like try and be friends.
Somebody I can't remember who it was, I'm very sorry, said that the way to stop it is with cat videos and happy memes and love.
That could also work.
Oh, Mike, thank you so much. Before we go, is there anything that you'd like to plug?
Yeah, no, I'm going to plug my reflection of this, because I think that like going back onto our theme of the podcast, like self-reflection and feedback are so important. So when you reached out to me, I'd never done a podcast before.
You've done brilliantly.
Yeah, I did. And one of the things I was taught early on is how you can feel nervous and excited, and they're actually the same feeling. So like in those butterflies in the stomach. So I was nervous at first, but then I just told myself, hey, isn't this exciting? And then I felt really excited and the energy built up. So yeah, this has been like really fun for me and like a new experience and, you know, to try something new. And I just think that everyone should be trying new things that are different, because that's how it, you know, it adds to personal growth.
Definitely. It's been a real pleasure. It had gone out of my head that this is your first podcast. You're a pro. You're a natural. Mike, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.